tied into the Espionage Act, which was passed in 1917, and Sauceda Press is named after one of the victims of the Espionage Act. Peter.
Hello.
I'm going to introduce Peter right now. This is Peter Kuttner. He helped organize this show, and he's going to introduce Chris and Pat. Thanks.
Thank you. I was once one of you walking down the street and walked in, and I basically never left. I fell in love with the gallery, and I'm one of the volunteers, and I'm honored to be part of the family. Thank you. Grandma usually has cookies, but not tonight. So I got elected to figure out what the art might be. I think it was a combination of knowing that we would do Salcedo at some point and that we had to do something from 1917. And it seemed, once I read about the 1917 Espionage Act, which then led into the Sedition Act a year later, and ended up throwing people like Eugene Debs into jail for speaking out against the war, that was the link. So if you don't mind, I'm going to read something I wrote. I often speak extemporaneously, but we're calling the show For Other Purposes. 100 years ago in 1917, Congress passed the Espionage Act just 2 months after the U.S. entered World War I. All laws passed by the U.S. government are assigned two names. The shorter one is merely intended to provide a convenient name for referring to it, as the Espionage Act. The longer one provides a description of the purpose or scope of the legislation. As its name indicates, the Espionage Act was designed to arrest and prosecute spies. That's the short version. The official longer title reveals much more about how the law was used to discourage dissent not only to the war, but to any government policy. And I'm now going to read this longer version. I think they call it the long title or something. And I quote, an act, actually I quote from the law, not from the paper that I wrote. So that's double air quotes. An act to punish acts of interference with the foreign relations and the foreign commerce of the United States, to punish espionage and better to enforce the criminal laws of the United States and for other purposes. That leaves the door open and why we call the show For Other Purposes. The wording of the Espionage Act left a great deal of room for aggressive prosecutors and overzealous patriots to interpret it as they wished. Things got worse the next year when Congress passed a more draconian amendment to the act that outlawed statements during the war that were, quote again, disloyal, profane, scurrilous, or abusive about the form of government of the United States. Opens the door even wider. Among those charged with offenses under the act were socialist labor leader and four-time U.S. presidential candidate Eugene V. Debs and anarchist activists Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman. In 1919, the Attorney General of the period, A. Mitchell Palmer, led the infamous Palmer raids, targeting communist and anarchist immigrants, and used the powers of the act as justification for arrests leading to deportations. Now we're getting closer to Salcedo himself. In June of 1919, Palmer's home was bombed, and a year later, the headquarters of the J.P. Morgan Bank on Wall Street. Although neither was related to the war, Espionage Act's longer description kicked in, better to enforce the criminal laws of the United States and for other purposes. In the interest of those other purposes, the investigation of the bombings led to the arrest and subsequent death while in police custody of Andreo Salcedo. But you're going to tell us more about that, right? So, Yuri Eichen joins the progressive community in Chicago in celebrating Salcedo Press with a 40-year retrospective of their posters called For Other Purposes. I speak much better without the paper. And I'd like to introduce two of the founders, yes, of Salcedo Press, my old friends Chris Burke and Pat Gleason. Well, that's true. It just occurred to me
that she could be Chris Burke and be Pat Gleason.
Yes. Okay, you're going to end the option.
Okay, thank you, Chris.
Okay, thanks. Thanks for coming out. I don't usually speak extemporarily. In fact, I got into this whole project because I didn't want to go to meetings and have to speak. I just wanted something that I could do in physical and see when it was done, and that was the way I wanted to contribute to the movement. So it's kind of ironic that I'm up here. But I'm going to start with the backstory. Salcedo Press was started in September of 1969 as the print co-op at the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana. Some local student activists and outside agitators were producing an underground newspaper, The Walrus. And typically for those times, it was anti-war, pro-civil rights, political commentary, music reviews, dope prices. And we had it printed by a commercial printer in Rantoul, which was an Air Force base town about 40 miles away. Until one issue, he began arbitrarily removing pieces he didn't like. Obscenities about Nixon, naked people. I mean, we got it back, and there were spaces where these things were supposed to be. And so a group of us decided that freedom of the press could only exist if we had our own presses. Most of us were, at the time, members of the SDS, local SDS chapter, for those of you who know what that was. And we acquired some used printing equipment and became competent to an extent, printing for local causes, some in the wider area, like Northern, Southern Illinois universities, and local community groups, the Boycott Movement in Cairo, Illinois. So that went on 3 years. By 72, with the draft ending and the student movements cooling off, we decided to move the project to Chicago and renamed it Salcedo Press, after an Italian-born anarchist printer who was arrested during the Palmer raids in New York in 1920. He was held for 8 weeks before being thrown from a window by the Bureau of Investigations in New York City. And his better-known associates, Sacco and Vanzetti, were picked up 2 days later. We started in Westtown at Palina, Milwaukee for about a year, and then we moved to Damon and Lake Industrial Area for the next 20 years. And we bought the building that's been our home since 1994 near Chicago and Kedzie. Salcedo's always been run collectively. It just seemed to us to be the sensible way to do things. No one wanted to replicate the boss-worker dichotomy. And over time, we've come to appreciate other advantages. You know, collaboration comes naturally. Worker owners have a direct stake in how the business does. So there's very little slacking, and supervisors are not needed. People are, you know, self-motivated. We also took the craft of printing seriously. When we began, mimeographs were still pretty common, and the attitude on the left was kind of too often, if they can read it, it's good enough. And we understood that all the effort that you went into writing or producing the piece meant nothing if it was just dropped in the trash without a second look, and I saw a lot of that, you know. It's just there on the ground. It was obvious we were competing with the sophisticated propaganda efforts of the American advertising industry. And in an information-saturated society, we wanted our work to be of the highest quality possible in order to do justice to the images and messages. Also, we realized we couldn't survive doing only movement work, and we'd need to do some commercial work to survive as a business. So we developed contacts in the arts, areas like theater, music groups, and music venues. We succeeded in making a modest living this way for all this time. It's been an honest living. Doing posters like these that call people to resist and envision a better world has been the best part of it. This is the fun stuff. We don't do this every day. We, you know, do a number of these a year, but it's rewarding. It's a very good feeling to see piles of these at the end of the day, drying overnight, waiting to be cut down the next day so they can be posted or taken into the streets. And other than that, you know, I don't feel that these belong to anybody. some of the, you know, I'd have to recognize the artists who produced them, mostly unpaid, mostly donated. This group over here. Actually, I should get into the May Day Blast. The May Day Blast began as rent parties. and then to celebrate the end of the Vietnam War in 75. And then they just took on a life of their own for the next 30 years. There's something about dancing and celebrating in a factory that felt more genuine, and it was a lot more fun on a day honoring working people than simply hearing speeches by labor leaders in the Civic Center. As time went on, we were able to send significant donations from the proceeds to causes from campaigns for political prisoners, helping out sister print shops in Southern Africa and Nicaragua, the American Indian Center, or hurricane relief in Mexico or New Orleans. They became known as the Spring Mating Ritual of the Left in Chicago. Thousands of people came over the years. And they still live on. We know of at least a few youngish folks who are the offspring of those nights. So, yeah, just, you know, really, as I said, nobody really owns these images. They kind of belong to a certain time and place in history. And, you know, everybody contributed as a collaborative effort. The artists, as I said, we put the ink on paper, sort of a midwife thing. But then it was also the organizers and everybody else who took them out in the streets and made use of them. So, thanks. Yeah, any questions? We'd be happy to answer.
If you're going to answer a question, stand close.
I will.
Well, we want answers to the question.
How long was the Walrus published?
I think till, it was a couple of years before we really got involved there.
And then it changed its name and became the Boneyard Examiner.
And the Geek.
And the Geek after that.
I don't know if you said when the Walrus started publishing. You said when?
Probably 65, I'm guessing, maybe 66. And it kept up into about 70, I think. Yeah. Aaron Fagan was on. Yeah.
Are you going to tell us about your role? You want to tell us about your role?
I wasn't
going to
know.
Mary just pointed something out that was interesting. When was it? In November? Last September, we did a show on the Rainbow Coalition, which was a lot about newspapers, because all of the members of that coalition, which was sort of formed around the Black Panther Party of Illinois and the ideas of Fred Hampton, of all the communities joining together, and each one had their own newspaper, and one of the newspapers was from a white working class organizing group called Rising Up Angry, and we took, again, from the Panthers, the idea of having a back page cartoon, and one of the people that started, that you just mentioned, Aaron Fagan, started at where, the Walrus, or the Boneyard?
The Walrus, yeah. Yeah.
Was that yeah. Yeah. A lot of words for.
Yeah.
The technology of printing and of media has changed so much over the years, and so many of the cooperatives like Salcedo still aren't around. And I'm wondering how you guys dealt with that and why you think you managed to continue to exist and thrive, whereas others of, you know, like you, are no longer in business.
Stubbornness, unwilling to acknowledge reality.
He's really unwilling to go to work for somebody else. That's really
I'm unemployable.
He does not want to buy.
We do, you know, we miss checks periodically. It's a drag, and then we get paid back, you know, eventually, and we adjust to that. You know, we did have, after the recession, it was already, the writing was kind of on the wall. We had two full-time large pressmen and three people in the stripping, plate-making, assembling area. And then we had a hailstorm that kind of destroyed our roof and skylights and pretty much everything else. But it turned out to be a blessing because...
It almost made me believe in God.
Yeah, we had paid our insurance and Hanover gave us $500,000, which was pretty much the damage. It was a new roof, was, you know, close to $100,000 alone. But we managed to get a, you know, automated plate maker, and and then also brought in a digital printer. And we probably would not be around if that hadn't happened. unfortunately, we had to let about three good people and one not so good person go. So we're kind of at about half staff of what we were then. A lot as is the technology. Once we brought the plate maker in, you know, the jobs were redundant and there was nothing we could do about it. And the presses, the large presses, used to have two guys there 5 days a week. Now we run it 4 times a month and the guy comes in on contract. You know, so that part's gone. If it wasn't for the digital, which is kind of like those pieces over there, the everyone is welcome. You know, most of those 12 by 18 are all the digital ones. And it's nice because you can get a perfect quality full color print for about $2. And, you know, before, if you're printing full color, you had to put $300-$400 into plates and ink washes before you got a single sheet off. So it did, you know, kind of democratize the, you know, the process.
So not only do you have the technology change in printing, but you also have the change in the movement. And really, you can just see this is, I mean, Saucero Press wouldn't be around if it weren't for the movement doing this kind of work. But over the years, like, how many underground newspapers do you get? And, you know, The Nation and people like that, they're doing it using a whole different technology. They're not doing sheet fed because that's way too expensive. If you're a community organization and you do a newsletter, you send it by email. You post it online. You're not going to pay the outrageous postage costs. And so everything has changed on us. And if Chris really were willing to work for somebody else, maybe we wouldn't still be doing this. But I think the impetus always lies in the movement and the vision that things could be better, things could be different. It doesn't need to be organized the way it is.
Yeah. It just seemed like a project that ought to be done, and it appealed to me, and nobody ever told me not to come to work. So, like,
can I bring it back to the espionage act?
Please.
Please do.
Yes.
I left out two really interesting facts, is that the Espionage Act didn't go away. It's still on the books. And it was used against Daniel Ellsberg in the Pentagon Papers, and more recently with Edward Snowden. And worse, because she ended up in jail, Chelsea Manning. So I want to ask you guys something, because you told me something when we met over at the office, and I don't think it came across. What the newspaper that came back from the self-censoring printer looked like?
Yeah, there were blank spaces. I mean,
there was like a big chunk, the whole article would be gone.
Yeah,
so you would open the paper and that picture wouldn't be there. And then, did you ever go back to him?
No, that's when we got, that's when he bought the press, yeah.
And then being a union member, I have to ask you that I'm not so interested in him not being able to work for somebody else. But what's it like working for him?
I don't know, because I never have.
It's true. So you're the wrong person to ask.
Yeah.
He doesn't know what it's like working for me either.
No, it is a...
You can cross the line into incorrect.
It's been a democratic... It's one person, one member, one vote. And we've divided labor according to people's aptitudes and, you know, the needs of the shop. But there has never been a general director of any sort. There's been a production manager,
so
I guess.
Sometimes we really needed one.
Yeah, we have needed, yeah, right. But it's been, you know, it's been as, you know, I think we realized we had to make it democratic. That just came natural, like I said. But also, and then later on, we realized it had to be sustainable because we were making $75 a week through most of the 70s. And, you know, and yeah, we did join the CWA in the late 70s, so we've been in with...
Which was a typographical,
Typographical union.
So they merged?
I meant the ITU, yeah.
Would you share that little fact you gave me earlier?
Yes, we were so happy when the typographical union agreed that they would let us organize and recognize us and give us a union label and stuff. Because it's a very cool union. It's the first union, I think it was 1794 or 1796 or something like that, the first trade union that called women members and gave them union cards and stuff. So it's the first one in the country, and it was in the trees. And it was always a very literate union. So they were, the typographicals were really instrumental in helping organize the work for the eight-hour day in Chicago and stuff, and all the stuff that led to May Day. So Albert Parsons, for example, was a member of our union. And so it was kind of neat, like getting to be part of that history.
Someone told me he worked as a typesetter at the Tribune.
I don't know if it was a Tribune back then.
It could have been. Very well, could have been. Yeah.
He was a typesetter. Don?
When did Salcedo go to a large format presses? And did you ever consider using web press? And I asked the latter one because when we were producing a tabloid, we had to go to Wisconsin to find anybody who would do a web press at a newspaper.
And we lost some of our best customers over the years. I mean, people who were like our top 10 customers, for example, Old Town School of Folk Music, because they had to go to web. It just didn't make any sense to do sheet-fed any longer once they got to be so successful. So we lost customers because they went out of business or because they really succeeded. This is ironic.
Yeah. We that was kind of from the very beginning. We bought a guy, actually after we started, after the Walrus couldn't be done there anymore, this one guy in Peoria who was an anarchist, he was pretty skilled, but we didn't get along with him politically, but he did it out of his basement, and it had a Mealy rotoprint, so it's 12 and a half by 19. And it was a clunky press, but it actually would print really nice if you could ever get it to run. And so we actually started out with a larger format than most people were running multi-lists, which were 11 by 17 or even 8 and a half by 11. And then the student government, which the leftists managed to infiltrate and take over, bought us an A.B. Dick brand new in 72. And that was a 1722 press. And I think that Gary Tyler Swapo poster up there is from that. That was run on that machine. And then, pardon me?
Wow.
And then we moved to Chicago. And then within a year, this old equipment dealer who I think had some left sympathies, somebody called me up and said Red Star Press, which had been at Halstead and Division actually was closing, and the guy who ran it was a junkie, and it was a long story. So we went in there and offered him $1,500 for everything, and that had a 29-inch Harris single color press. So suddenly we can do 29-inch presses, which is a really, they were all single color back then, but this was a format that not a lot of people had access to, so that was kind of neat. So. People came to us, with a lot of stuff just for that reason. A lot of these are from those days, Yes?
The artwork on the May Day Blast poster is quite eclectic. How do you pick who gets to do the artwork every year?
Sometimes we thought ahead and actually contacted people and, We didn't usually say, three people do a design, we'll pick one. We usually decided who we wanted to do it that year for various reasons. And then sometimes we didn't get it together, and so then we, begged people. Could you have something by tomorrow, please?
In general, the people, we commissioned for the May Day posters. I mean, there were some great ones. I'm going to mention just a few. Alejandro Romero, Nori Davis, Dean Ewing. Bruce Howell, Carlos Roldan did a few.
Gary Borman.
Gary Borman's, yeah. But what we did with them, we offered them, we'd buy their canvas, we'd buy their paint, and we'd give them 500 prints that they could, sign as artists and sell as artist proofs or something. And they all agreed to it. So that was, and we gave them a theme which started out kind of in the early ones, people partying and putting cigarette butts out in the Guacamole. And, it carried on, Marx dancing in the press room. And so they all got the idea and the joke and kept it on. So it worked pretty well.
Thanks. Any more questions?
Yeah. Were you ever visited by the FBI?
No. Yes. When I moved to Chicago, I had come back from Cuba the previous, the previous summer, and they were in the process, they had followed me around for about 6 months, and moved to Chicago, they came to my house within a couple of days, they came to my workplace within a couple of days. They never came to us. A city building...
Announcing themselves.
There might have been some shady people. But at one point, the electrical inspector showed up, and very kind of distinguished-looking Polish man with silver hair. And it turned out he was Roman Paczynski's brother. Pipe was doing our electrical work, and he was skilled. But his boss was covering us with the license. And so he took the thing to his boss, and the boss said, you know, give him $300. We gave him $300, and it kind of felt like we were like, welcome to Chicago. You know what I mean? Because they left us alone. The guy came in and he said, somebody told me to lay off you guys. You know, I don't know what it was.
The thing is, I think, you know, certainly this has been true in the Cuba work too, that the FBI prefers to get people alone. Just not see. So in our workplace, there's going to be too many people there. So they chose to visit us in our homes. So it's, you know, the old isolate. The same thing with the people who've been doing Cuba solidarity work. They don't show up at a Cuba meeting. They come to your house at a separate time because they want to isolate people from each other.
Well, they're probably already at the Cuba
meeting.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Being a collective, there was no boss that they could go to.
That's
and
true.
Say, this guy is, we want you to get rid of this person.
Yeah.
Another reason for collectives.
Yeah, do you have a question?
Yeah.
Curious how the FBI is kind of friends now. But anyway.
I know. Sorry.
I was just wondering what
can't weep about him losing his job, you know?
Who are your customers or what's your business right now? What do you do most?
There's still a lot of community organizations, you know, Logan Square, Communities United, a lot of different. You know,
this is all stuff that's very recent.
Yeah, I mean, there's...
The Women's March, the Immigrant Rights Movement.
Yeah, and there are still, you know, some commercial kind of theater groups, you know, people like that. I mean, the one thing that's great is I've never had to print anything really offensive. I mean, the worst thing was when some politician here endorsed Blagojevich and we had to put his name under that. But we, you know, nobody...
There was one thing, though, that came in. We couldn't do it on their schedule, and it was really expensive, and so they went somewhere else.
Yeah, yeah.
That was one piece. What?
Have you turned work away?
Well, no. We didn't say we won't print this because we don't agree with it. We said, oh, we can't make your schedule, and man, it's going to be thousands of dollars.
Yeah, I mean, I think we were on shaky legal ground and realized it, and it might have been just a bait. So we kind of tripled the price, and I can't even remember who the... I can't what the issue was, but we resolved if we had to do it and the job cost $1,000, we're going to charge $3 and give $2,000 to the other group. But we never had to do it. That's great. We've never tried to be the cheapest place in town. There have been about a dozen of these over the years, and they all went under. So we weren't going to go that way. And like I said, we took the craft seriously. We paid attention at every step, and it's easy to mess up. There's hundreds of, you know, false steps that can be made. We've made every one of them at least once. And, you know, at least we guarantee our work also. So it's people would pay more, but the quality was guaranteed, is guaranteed.
Anyway, hey, thanks all for coming. So to remind you, the second Friday of every month.